Les ruego tomar asiento, por favor.
I think we can continue our work, please.
If you want, stay all the way.
Se declara abierta la décima sesión del foro permanente para las cuestiones indígenas. Esta tarde, de conformidad con su programa de trabajo, el foro permanente seguirá examinando el tema 7 del programa titulado Labor Futura del Foro Permanente.
We're going to be working on the rest of 7, including issues related to ECOSOC and other issues. We will have presentation and study of the following reports. Studies on indigenous fishing rights in the sea, study to determine the impact of or the consideration and recognition of the rights of Mother Earth. This morning, the forum began the debate on a number of studies done by the forum during the course of the year. In this meeting, we will be looking at the studies that I just mentioned. First, the permanent forum will hear presentation of the study on indigenous fishing rights in the seas. I now give the floor to our distinguished colleague, Cáceres Smith. Mr. Smith, you have the floor.
Present this report on indigenous fishing rights in the seas. That is a study made by my colleague Mick Dodson and myself as special rapporteurs. This report includes an analysis of the indigenous fishing rights in the seas provided by the existing international framework and then case studies from Australia and Norway. I shall now briefly, in the few minutes we have at disposal, first present the international law part and then Norway's legal and political situation, where the international law consequences are intensively debated these days. In international law, there are no rules or principles dealing specifically with indigenous rights to salt sea fishing. The position of coastal indigenous peoples must be derived from more general instruments. A combination of the historic coastal uses and the international law instruments protecting indigenous cultures constitutes the foundation for the fishing rights. The two main conventions of relevance are the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the ILO Convention 169. The paper considers these conventions with a view to their impact on uses of resources by indigenous peoples in the areas where they live and have traditionally developed their coastal indigenous culture. The analysis includes the declaration as well as material from the Human Rights Committee and ILO. In conclusion, the analysis supports the view that the covenant protects the right to fish when this is an essential part of the culture. Furthermore, the ILO Convention constitutes a principle of consultation and participation in state regulation of the fisheries. With regard to the case study from Norway, the most well-known fact in literature about the indigenous people of Norway, the Sami people, is their reindeer herding. However, fishing has always been a main livelihood for the many Sami, the so-called Sea Sami, living permanently in seaside areas. Sami fishing has very much been a small-scale activity in the fjords and the near coastal waters. The sea fisheries underwent drastic change in the late 1980s when quotas of cod were introduced. The regulation linked quotas to vessels and not to fishes. These quotas were distributed on the basis of the quantity of the catch in previous years, resulting in small vessels in Sami fishing communities to a large degree falling outside the new system. A coastal fishing committee concluded in 2008 that Sami living in fjords and along the coast of the county Finnmark, the most northern county, they do have rights to fish, which are based on their historical use and rules of international law. This right to fish is developed in a draft statute, both in relation to allowable catches and to exclusive rights in some areas. A regional administration is part of the draft, where the board is to be composed of three representatives elected by the Sami Parliament and three from the county council. An extensive hearing gave us result that big trade organizations spoke against the proposal, whereas local fishers, the Sami Parliament, and many of the municipalities were positive. The Attorney General has thereafter released a document that is negative towards the committee's report. Negative both regarding its international law analysis and its statutory proposal. There was a response from the leader of the committee, a rather sharp response. The principal elements of discussion are Sami rights to the material basis of culture and their rights to necessary special measures. These are two basic principles. The Minister of Fisheries has in October of 2009 publicized the first official reaction to the report. The minister will propose certain rights, but far more minor than in the draft, and will not recognize the international law basis. The governmental position is these days basis for consultations between the government and the Sami Parliament. Finally, fishing is essential for securing Sea Sami culture, which is in a critical state of existence. A view expressed by the Permanent Forum might have an impact on the present political decision making, and it should have such an impact. My colleague Mick Dodson will now present the other part of our report, and he will introduce our common draft recommendation. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor Smith. Ahora.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Now, our other colleague, Mike Hobson, will present the second part of the study. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon. I hope you had a nice lunch. I'll deal with the section of our study which relates to Australia. And as my friend and colleague, Mr. Smith, has said, I'll also introduce our proposed recommendation for the consideration of our colleagues on the forum. Mr. Chairman, culture manifests itself in many forms, including a particular way of life associated with the use of land resources, especially in the case of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous Australians, including my people, the Yarru people, have a long history of close association with the sea and its resources for our subsistence, economic livelihood, spirituality, and cultural identity. These connections are well supported by archaeological and anthropological evidence. We do not distinguish between landscape and seascape, both being equally part of country. And this contrasts markedly with the worldview reflected by the Australian legal system, which perceives boundaries where Indigenous conceptualisations provide a geographically integrated understanding of land, rivers, estuaries, beaches, reefs, seas, and associated flora and fauna. Indigenous rights and interest in Australian land and waters predated and survive the imposition of British sovereignty. This was recognised by the High Court of Australia in 1992 through the recognition of native title in Mabo versus Queensland. Since then, Mr. Chairman, a complex legislative system has taken precedent in defining the framework regulating the field of native title law. The Native Title Act of 1993 specifically includes fishing rights as capable of falling within native title interest. While the Native Title Act does not treat sea country claims differently to those over land, Section 212 protects the existing Crown ownership in natural resources, in the control and regulation of water flow, and the existing public access to and enjoyment of various offshore waters, such as foreshores and beaches. In Australia, in Australian native title law to date, there has been no recognition of exclusive commercial Indigenous rights to sea country. Until the Croker Island Sea case in 2001, which dealt solely with native title rights over sea country, there was no determination of any form of native title offshore. Native title is subject to rights under Commonwealth and state laws, allowing, for instance, recreational and commercial fishing and shipping in native title areas. The Croker Island case was the first successful case determining both the Act and common law are capable of recognising native title offshore. Since the Croker Island case, various cases have extended the recognition of native title along Australia's coastline and over its seas and seabed. The Wellesley Islands case in 2004 provided useful guidance on how and in what form native title is recognised below the high water mark. Affirming the reasoning in Croker Island, this case also recognised non-exclusive, non-commercial native title rights over parts of the areas claimed, finding the continued existence of native title rights of control of access and use in the waters and submerged lands of the intertidal zone and territorial seas impossible without fatal inconsistency with common law, public and international law rights. The Blue Mud Bay native title case in 2007 involved claim areas over both land and offshore waters. The court in this case recognised the Yolngu people's non-exclusive right to the intertidal zones and adjacent sea areas claimed. In relation to the intertidal zone, the court found that even in non-navigable waters, the common law public right to fish would be exercisable in the entire intertidal zone, which includes waters affected by arms of the sea, such as rivers, streams and estuaries. Mr. Chairman, the Torres Straits is that body of water between Australia and Papua New Guinea, where the Pacific and the Indian Oceans meet, and where there are 133 islands, sandy cays and rocky outcrops, of which 38 are inhabited. These waters and islands cover approximately 49,000 square kilometres. This region is unique, as in native title law, in the respect that it is the home of Australia's Torres Strait Islander Indigenous peoples, who are culturally distinct from mainland Aboriginal peoples, and it is the subject of an international treaty. Native title was first recognised in this region through the Mare Island case, more commonly known as the Mabo case. This did not involve offshore rights, but rights to land. The Torres Strait Treaty between Australia and Papua New Guinea entered into force in 1985 and recognises Indigenous offshore rights to fish. It enables a protected zone to safeguard traditional ways of life and livelihoods of traditional inhabitants. A significant proportion, Mr. Chairman, of Australian fisheries production is exported, including valuable products such as rock lobster, pearls, abalone and tuna. Australia's federal constitution vests exclusive authority to control Australia's fisheries in the Commonwealth, which possesses power to control all activity in its territorial waters. Although conceptually nearly inseparable from native title, cultural heritage can also encompass much wider notions than sites of significance and is accordingly subject to separate legislative arrangements. Cultural heritage matters frequently overlap with native title interest in land and waters, and sometimes with land rights. Land rights, Mr. Chairman, is a term that refers to a variety of statutory grants under different conditions and capable of a variety of legal remedies, in some instances compensation. This is usually communally held by a group rather than individuals, and there are usually restrictions on alienating and dealing with the title. The High Court of Australia recently decided on a land rights case involving competing interests created under statutory permits for non-Indigenous fishers on the land that was subject of a statutory grant of Indigenous land rights title under the Fisheries Act of the Northern Territory. The court held that despite obtaining a permit, non-Indigenous fishers still required permission from the Indigenous peoples to enter and fish on their land. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my report on our study to this meeting. I want to conclude, though, by putting the following proposals for consideration of our colleagues. The Permanent Forum, having analysed and discussed Indigenous fishing rights in the seas on the basis of a report submitted by the Special Rapporteurs, the Permanent Forum thereby recommends that states where Indigenous peoples are living in coastal areas recognise their right to fish in the seas based on historical use and international law. The Permanent Forum considers the protection of the material basis of culture of Indigenous peoples to be part of international law, and that should be applied also to fishing rights in the sea. The Permanent Forum notes in this context the ongoing consultations between the Norwegian government and the Sami Parliament. I commend our report to the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Muchas gracias.
I want to thank the two presenters for that excellent introduction to the study dealing with the rights of Indigenous peoples to seas and oceans, and especially fishing rights. And this is something that obviously is very important, because while there are still conflicts on issues of land ownership, here we have an interesting example for other peoples. I'm thinking of my own people, where the fishing rights of Indigenous peoples are not only not ruled upon, but they're not even mentioned. This is something that should be followed up on and the subject of a much more far-reaching study, inasmuch as here we have taken only two cases into account. I feel that inasmuch as the Indigenous peoples have traditionally lived from fishing, and this is very important for the Permanent Forum and for Indigenous delegates, that is, the need to enlarge this study, and it would be very interesting for Dobson and Smith to propose a much more broader study of the case. The Permanent Forum will now study the study on the need to recognize the rights of Mother Earth, which was assigned by the Permanent Forum to me and to Mr. Bartolomé Clavero. And I want to invite Mr. Clavero to come to the Bureau to make the presentation. Mr. Clavero. You have the floor, Mr. Clavero. Thank you very much, sir. The eighth session last year decided that there was a need for a study on the need to respect the rights of Mother Earth, and the current chairman of the forum, Carlos Mamani, and myself were appointed rapporteurs. The study has three parts, one devoted to international law, the second part covering the Indigenous people's conception of Mother Earth, and the third, alternatives that come close to the indigenous idea of Mother Earth as expressed in Western thinking. But we are going to present only a summary of the first two parts. The first part that I'm going to present has to do with the area of international law, and it has to do with the possibility of recognition of the rights of Mother Earth. Last year, the United Nations General Assembly, in its session, heard, among other things, issues dealing with the environment, biodiversity, climate change, desertification, water as a vital resource, and also a draft resolution which was adopted on harmony with nature. This draft was sponsored by the plurinational state of Bolivia, but under a different title. The proposed title was Harmony with Mother Earth. And this proposal is important because Mother Earth is the translation of the Pachamama, which is the symbiosis between humanity and nature, which should be the basis for recognition of the rights of Mother Earth as something that is vital to humanity itself. Of the original language, there was a trend toward a change in the UN position with regard to the recognition of Mother Earth. This intention was not lost in the resolution on harmony with nature, but there is one point that disappeared and was not discussed by the GA and which was included in the original proposal, which was the possibility of a declaration of principles, a possible declaration of principles and ethical values for a life or a life in harmony with Mother Earth. One might say, and I think it is true, that the study done by Carlos Mamani and myself aims at recovering that suggestion, that is, a possible declaration of values and ethics intended to achieve harmony with Mother Earth. This study went on to recall part of the history of United Nations positions on nature to give that possibility in its proper context. The history begins where the awareness of the United Nations organization begins. The United Nations Environment Program was also given the mission of directing and fostering participation in care for the environment by giving peoples the education and resources to improve their quality of life without endangering future generations. In 1972, there was the United Nations Conference on the Human Environment and the Action Plan, which began to identify problems and to define policies without taking into consideration the existence of indigenous peoples' territories or even the very existence of indigenous peoples. A document as important as the World Nature Charter, which was adopted by the GA in 1982, still did not take into account the presence of indigenous peoples, although it assumes part of their conception of nature. The Charter of 1982 declares that there is awareness of the fact that the human race is part of nature, what was called a symbiosis, And in the Andean territories, this is called the Pachamama. And if you do not consider the existence of indigenous peoples, you would not refer to the Pachamama. The Charter also expresses the conviction that all forms of life are unique and deserve to be respected, whatever their utility for humanity. It is also persuaded that the lasting benefits to be derived from nature will depend on the protection of ecological processes and the essential systems that are necessary for survival and diversity of forms of life. The Charter not only ignored the indigenous peoples, some of whose conceptions were already being assimilated, but it said in 1982 that there must be full cognizance of the sovereignty of states over its natural resources. Under that principle, there is no way that you can acknowledge the rights of indigenous peoples as we understand it. In 1987, we had the definition of the international paradigm, which exists up until today, on nature. That international paradigm is today in force, and it is the one contained in the report, Our Common Future, issued by the World Commission on Environment and Development, a report also known as the Brundtland Report, in honor of a person, Brundtland, who chaired the commission. In that study, they recognize the category of sustainable development in a protected environment, where the analysis of the economic, political, and social dimensions are considered, not the forms of submission of some areas to the superiority of others, as is happening still with indigenous communities. Part of the Brundtland Report recognizing rights and duties does not take into account the rights of indigenous peoples. The ultimate development is sustainable development, and still development, and then sustainability, which is also important. In that report, the relevant responsibilities are incumbent on states. The states decide. Now, accompanied by the responsibilities of international institutions and NGOs, but with no recognition of the indigenous peoples. Then the report goes into the progressive acknowledgement, both with a very low profile, of the presence of indigenous peoples in the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in 1992, the Rio Summit, and the Biodiversity Convention, as well as in 1992 in Rio, Program 21 and Chapter 26, which is devoted to the acknowledgement and strengthening of the role of indigenous populations and indigenous communities, the same kind of language that appears in the Biodiversity Convention, that is, a language that it is not the indigenous peoples that are recognized as holders of the rights to the territories and the resources where this biodiversity exists. Chapter 26 of Program 21 substantially contained, as we see it, an implementation of the Brundtland paradigm to the indigenous case, proposing the category of autonomous, sustainable development of indigenous communities. But let us not fool ourselves. This is very limited. Communities, they say, not peoples. Sustainable autochthonous development without any implication of self-determination. The states continue to make the basic decisions on the relationship of humanity with nature, to state it in a more general manner. Then the study analyzes the implementation of the climate change protocol and the protocol, the Kyoto Protocol. There too you have a ignorance of the rights of peoples, of indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples are notoriously hurt by climate change, which is not their responsibility, but also they are hurt by many of the policies addressed to stop climate change and which have been adopted internationally without the consent or participation of the indigenous peoples. For all of these burning and urgent issues dealing with the environment, sustainable development, as it is still called, biodiversity, climate change, the key is linked to a number of rights that are now acknowledged by the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, beginning with the basic right, which should inspire all the other rights, which is the right to self-determination, not only politically, also socially, economically, culturally. In fact, the entire Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, with all of the changes in policies and practices, that implementation should require by all United Nations bodies, the member states, and the indigenous peoples, who are the ones that are the most interested. These cultural, political, and social economic policies require, above all, participation and consent of the indigenous peoples. I am about to conclude. The Declaration acknowledges the rights of indigenous peoples to their own material resources, their use according to their own aspirations and needs, in accordance with their strategic aims for development based on their own cultural conceptions, including the symbiotic relationship between humanity and nature. The Conventions on Climate Change and Ecological Diversity must also acknowledge the representation of indigenous peoples, not only in policies, but in conceptions. Thus, the indigenous peoples would enter in the mainstream internationally, not only to defend their rights and interests, but also to contribute to the well-being and prosperity of humanity with their own conceptions, such as the concept of Mother Earth, Pachamama, and the good life, Suma Kausai, Nyandereko, Tekokapi, and many other indigenous peoples' expressions that refer to the good life for humanity in symbiosis with the Mother Earth, the Pachamama. The second part will be presented by my colleague Carlos Mamani. Thank you. I will continue with the second part of the study. As my colleague said, there are examples of the conception that indigenous peoples have, particularly those of us of the Andes region. We're going to talk about the Andean conception of Mother Earth and with the historical depth that we can find in the colonial chronicles written by the Spaniards of the 16th century. The earth is sacred. The relationship of the political community with the earth is very important. The land welcomes. In Aymara, it is Yupacamama, although the most well-known is Pachamama. This is the most universalized name for Mother Earth. It is usually used in Quechua, in Aymara, and even in Spanish. Giovanni Anello de Oliva, who was a Jesuit priest from Italy who lived in the Andes in the 16th century, recorded the term with its true meaning. They also worshipped the fertile earth, which they call Pachamama, which means the fruitful Mother Earth. And this, I think, is the most complete concept that we have among the indigenous peoples of Earth. The fruitful mother conceives of the earth as the garden, the that is cultivated by people for their food. Nature provides sustenance. People and everyone on the earth are all members of a community of life. The quality of fecundity rests on that concept, that is, of harboring a living community that is continuously fruitful and renewed. In Aymara, breeding is Uyuyua. Another chronicler of the 16th century reported the worship of by the indigenous peoples of the earth, the stars, and so on, which he mentioned was known as Pachamama. This conception of the people of indigenous peoples of Peru was idolatry for the missionaries, something to be eliminated by conversion. And this form of colonization was such that the conception of this, of these beliefs, are obvious. One chronicler said that the indigenous peoples worshiped the sea so that it would give them fish. And we have just heard the studies by Mr. Smith and Dobson about the bounty of the sea. If you pour cornmeal into the sea, it would work. And the Andean peoples of the mountains also revered lakes and the sea, although they had never seen it. And they called it Mamacocha. And the Aymara called it Mamacota. And the people of the ridge also worshipped the sea through different ceremonies. And the snow-capped ridge was also worshipped by the Indians. Mother Earth is a greater concept that comprises others, such as Mamacocha or Pocoya, the queen, wife of the Inca, which is a name given to mines. These are the entrails of the earth. The same is said of the mines known as Hoya, which is revered in the metals and the ores that were worshipped by kissing them and holding ceremonies. The sacred consideration protects against depredation and exploitation. Mother Earth is a totalizing conception, and recognition and veneration was provided by sanctuaries, meeting places, and learning places. These sanctuaries were communicated by the paths that linked the territory with the center in Cusco, the Golden Garden, as it was known. Suirumama then is considered a jewel. The mines are what are considered the entrails of the world. Hoya Okoya, as identified with women, considered the earth to be the defender of pregnant women. And when she was about to have a baby, sacrifices were made to the earth. The spilling of water made the earth productive and fertile. That is why the earth is called Pachamama. In Wawamatwa, it says, Pachamama, I will be your son. This is what it refers to. But when Pachamama is named, they invoke the entire universe. Suirumama, the chakra, or the garden, expression of the fruitful garden, that whose sacredness is marked with a long stone, a pukara. It cannot be doubted that consideration of Mother Earth goes further than Suirumama, which is the fruitful mother, and leads to the origins of the peoples, thence the importance of certain sacred places known as Pacarinas, the most famous being Tambotojo. The Pacarinas are proof of the veneration of the indigenous peoples for the earth, because it defines the origin in its entrails, which are the Chincaya. Lumpaca talks about the quality of the earth in relation to cleanliness, which in this case might be considered hygiene and health. This is a broad-ranging concept of the respect we must have for Mother Earth. The contrary is a violation of laws and the rules, the paths to be walked by peoples. One concept that is currently very important in the Andes is Kamiri. And here I want to define this. Kamiri is a concept that, if it is to be understood, has to be translated, and is called Suma Kamanya, which is translated as the good life. Kamiri is the walker that has a full life. The country would be Pachacoya Cacre, which would be a miserable, homeless person. This is a concept that was also related by a Jesuit chronicler who was the author of the first Aymara dictionary in the 16th century. In the new writing of the Aymara language, it is called Koya. The miserable person is miserable toward the earth, to the world, and it is a poverty, a conceptual poverty, which says or describes he who does not know how to live. Pachacoya mainina isawanya sarnakata. This is living without the company of others and with humiliation. All those who follow the rules, the violator is a miserable being that is humiliated by those who do know how to live. Mother Earth is angered by violation. Fernando de Santillano of the 16th century said that when bad times came, they would say that the earth was angry and they made sacrifices. In the south of my country, they say Pachamama Kipusiu, which is the Mother Earth is angry. Pachamama, the fecund and fruitful mother. Those who know how to weed, kamiri, comes from the verb kama, which is also a concept that covers the concept of home. And it is the result of following the laws and the rules, which is harmony with nature and with the different facets of Mother Earth. Kamiri as a person is the possessor of sufficient resources in spirituality. It is one who knows of the requirements of the sun and the earth, another chronicler said. This all encloses a deep knowledge that is to be applied by the ruler, and it combines with the behavior of animals and nature, allowing for the prediction of phenomena such as droughts, rains, and freezes. Kamiri is a person to be respected. Ayi achachik machuyaya Wamam Pomada Dayala said, the one who knows everything of life will await the end of his days, teaching the younger generation. And this would be the role of older people who reincarnated in the mountains. Mother Earth has been conceptualized in the Andes to have a frame of reference with which to develop a universal vision shared by a diversity of particular cultures, the indigenous cultures in particular, the Mapuche people who originally lived in southern Argentina and Chile, are also considered people of the earth, Mapuche. And Mapudungu is a language of the earth. Mapu is the earth, and Che is people. And in this consideration, the earth is Nuke Mapo, Mother Earth, which in the political thought becomes Walmapu, which is territory. The Mapuche people consider themselves sons and daughters of the earth. Their efforts are aimed at recovering lands that were confiscated during the colonial period. These are people who feel that people and nature are a unity, and the Mapuche then are considered to be the fruit of the earth. But the word in Mapuche is much more significant. This is an offspring of the earth, a sprout of the earth, and they return to the earth with their death. This is also an important concept wherein the Mapuche person has his entire life looked over through a number of concepts which the community follows and whose violation gives rise to conflicts. This is not only individual, but it affects everyone. In conclusion, I am going to support what Evo Morales said, President Evo Morales said during the adoption on April 22nd of the Day of Mother Earth. He explained what he understands to be the rights of Mother Earth, and the right to life means the right to exist, the right for no animal species or ecosystem, no snowy lake should be eliminated or exterminated by irresponsible attitudes by human beings, and the right to the regeneration of biocapability. The Mother Earth must be able to regenerate its biodiversity. Human activity on the planet Earth and its resources cannot be considered unlimited. There is a limit, and that limit is the regeneration capability of vegetable, animal, and forestry resources, springs, and atmosphere. And the right to a clean life, which in this case remits us to the concept I had mentioned on Yumpacha and Suermama. This is the right of Mother Earth to live without pollution, because it is not only humans who have a right to a good life, but also rivers, fish, animals, trees, and the earth itself have a right to live in a sound environment free of poisons. The need for harmony and balance among all. It is the right of Mother Earth to be acknowledged as part of a system in which we are all interdependent. It is the right to coexist in a balance between human beings and the earth. Only human beings have the necessary conscience and capability to be able to establish and defend our harmony with nature. This is the study that we developed jointly, myself and Professor Clavero. Thank you for your attention.
Pasaremos ahora al...
Now we'll go on to the third study, the study of the effects of climate change adaptation members and the measures to mitigate climate change and its impact on the pasturing of reindeer. Lars Andersberg now has the floor to present that study.
Gentlemen, allow me first of all to inform my colleague members in the Permanent Forum and other participants in the ninth session about the special connection between the city of New York and reindeer herding. In the mid 1920s, a 7-day reindeer festival was held in New York, sponsored by Jimmy Walker, the vibrant New York mayor at that time. The theme of the festival was to inform the New York public that the reindeer meat was available at the local butcher's shop. Such celebrities as Ronald Amundsen, the first man to reach the South Pole, was enlisted in this campaign. The festival was a result of the introduction of reindeer herding in Alaska, later Canada. Many Sami reindeer herders from Norway, from the Norwegian side of the Sami, traditional Sami homeland, was engaged in these projects. Many of them stayed in Alaska and Canada. Reindeer has also over the years emerged as the Christmas icon, as the helper of Santa Claus. You have probably heard about the Rudolph the Red Nose. Mr. Chairman, at the 8th session last year, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues convened a half-day discussion on the Arctic. Based on the discussion, the Permanent Forum adopted several recommendations on the Arctic and the climate change. Climate change has an impact on all aspects of the life in the Arctic region, from traditional subsistence activities, including hunting, fishing, reindeer husbandry, farming, gathering, and food sovereignty, to community health. It has also been emphasized that the climate change and the environmental degradation related to natural resource extraction, such as mining, forestry, already constitute a great threat to the traditional lifestyles and cultures of indigenous peoples of the Arctic. Discussion held at the Permanent Forum sessions and in various conventions on the biological diversity framework, as well within United Nations Agency, have recently considered some of the challenges faced by the pastoralists in an effort to improve working relations with the different communities of pastoralists, mainly in Africa and Asia. And my study on the impact of climate change adaptation and mitigation measures on reindeer herding, contained in document E/C19/2010/15, speaks for itself, and I assume that the participants of this session have read the document. Due to the limit time, I will briefly highlight some issues contained in the study. Mr. Chairman, it has been estimated that the pastoralism is practiced on 25% of the global land area, providing 10% of the world meat production. In the Arctic, reindeer is the primary livestock production. It is slowly marginalizing due to the land pressure, ecological degradation, and climate change, particularly in the developing countries. In the past 50 years, around 25% of the reindeer pastures of the Euro-Arctic Barents region have in effect been lost as a result of the human development. This challenge is also particularly relevant today, as the Arctic is said to hold around 25% of the world's remaining undeveloped petrol resources, large deposits of minerals and unexploited forest. After the 15th session of the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, held in Copenhagen in December 2009, it is expected that the efforts to mitigate climate change by increased use of renewable resources such as windmills, hydroelectric dams, will intensify the pressure on grazing lands. In the north of Sweden, a Swedish-German joint venture is planning construction of a windmill park within the reindeer grazing lands of the Östra-Kikkijau Sami village. This is the biggest windmill park plan to date, and the government of Sweden have some weeks ago given a go-ahead to the project. The project will have a mainly negative effect on the reindeer husbandry in the concerned Sami community. At the same time, I will recognize that the Swedish government so far is the only government that have undertaken an investigation on the impact of climate change adaptation and mitigation measures on reindeer herding. I will also, in this context, acknowledge what have been done in the framework of the Arctic Council. Reindeer herding communities around the world have throughout the history managed to adapt to dramatic change, such as the process of colonization, inclusion of the traditional pastoral territories in the different nations, and the modernization. The cumulative effects of the land fragmentation, natural resource exploitation, dividing access to lands, of course, and rights, together with the multiple effects of climate change on the ecosystem in the Arctic, have put a hard pressure on the reindeer herding communities in the world. The situation of reindeer herding communities is complex, and due to the limitation of the framework of the present study, further study should be undertaken, and strategies and programs should be developed and implemented based on the principles in the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The project of the Evenki hydropower station in Krasnoyarsky Krai in Russia is an example of this complexity. The construction will flood about 1 million hectares of unique deciduous forest and pasture traditionally used by Evenki reindeer herders and hunters. It would also flood a chamber that contains radioactive brines left as a result of at least one of the underground nuclear explosions fired in the lower Tunguska floodplains in the 1970s. The hydroelectric power plant construction will destroy traditional use of the nature in this territory. The project is done without prior informed consent by the people concerned. Mr. Chairman, there is an urgent need to facilitate investigation and studies within the UN framework on the change of grazing lands in the reindeer herding areas in the circular polar north to establish a holistic and integrated understanding of the ongoing rapid change in reindeer herding communities, partly driven by the climate change and globalization, in order to maintain the sustainability and resilience of indigenous reindeer herding societies and cultures in the future. I therefore welcome the joint initiative of the United Nations Environmental Programme and the Association of the World Reindeer Herders Association and the International Centre for Reindeer Husbandry to assess the impact of land use change and climate change on nomadic pastoralism and their adaptation options and opportunities, focusing on taiga reindeer herding in Russia, Mongolia, China, and yak herding in the Himalayas. The objective of the project is to increase the resilience and the adaptation to climate change of nomadic communities while building partnership between reindeer and yak herding communities, strengthening local institutions and increasing the capacity of nomadic herders in how to engage in land use and natural resource management. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank the ELA project managed by the former chairman of the Permanent Forum, Mr. Ole Henrik Magga, at the University of Simon University Colleges, and along with Sven D. Mathisen and Executive Director Anders Oskal at the International Center for Reindeer Husbandry for their assistance in my work. So, thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor Larsen de Rivera.
Thank you very much, sir, for that excellent study. I am personally very much interested in this study, as well as the effects that our pastoral communities are receiving from climate change. I'm a llama herder. We breed llamas and alpacas. And those of us who do this now find ourselves with a very limited amount of pasture land and new diseases that are difficult to control. And this must be the situation with herders in different parts of the world, so that the situation that you have described among the reindeer herders might probably be also true for herders in other parts of the world, the herding of yaks and so on. Those of us who are herders of camelids would be in a situation similar to the Sami who live from herding reindeer. So again, let me thank you, sir, for that very important report. Let me go over to my list of speakers. But before doing that, I wanted to give the floor to my colleagues of the Permanent Forum to see if they have something to comment on the studies that we have heard this afternoon. You, sir, have the floor. Pavel?
Спасибо.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to thank all of my colleagues who prepared the reports, who have conducted the studies based on the topics that we decided. I wanted to say a few words with regard to what Lars Andreas Beyers has said. Reindeer herding for many of the northern peoples, all of the indigenous peoples who live in my country, is one of the most important activities, types of activities, an activity which, as we have already mentioned, determines the cultures, traditions, and the customs of these peoples. Now, very recently, in fact, just 10 days ago, the indigenous peoples of the Arctic region held the fifth summit of the leaders of the indigenous peoples of the Arctic in Moscow. At this Moscow summit, they talked about the industrial development in the Arctic with regard to climate change, new challenges for indigenous peoples. And once again, the representatives of indigenous peoples, the leaders of the Arctic region, indigenous population, said that in the context of climate change, in the context of the industrial development there, it is very important to safeguard the rights of indigenous peoples. I would like to read out just a couple of paragraphs from the Moscow Declaration, which was signed by the leaders of the indigenous peoples of the Arctic. From the indigenous peoples of Moscow was signed by President Trypon Sergei Harichi, from the Inuit Council Representative Jin Sots, on behalf of the Council of Sami Olaf Mari Sevitsa, who is the president of that committee, and on behalf of the Athabasca Council, William Binukresko signed this declaration. Now, these are the excerpts I wanted to read out from that declaration. We, the representatives of the indigenous peoples of the polar nations, met in Moscow and we discussed the outlook for the development of our peoples within the context of the industrial production in the Arctic in the context of climate change. We fully realize that the Arctic region possesses a great wealth of mineral resources, which modern civilization requires. The industrial development of the Arctic resources should not create an imbalance of the environment or undermine the rights of indigenous peoples or hamper their development. We appeal to all Arctic states to adopt and to realize the UN Declaration of the Rights of the Indigenous Peoples in order to guarantee that the industrial development of the Arctic circles should go through in the safeguard of the rights of the indigenous people and their rights. We appeal to the UN and its agencies, to the working bodies and institutes, to include the current programs or to create additional programs in order to assess and forecast the continuing development of the Arctic areas in the context of climate change and to safeguard the indigenous cultures of the indigenous peoples, to conduct monitoring activities with experts with regard to the indigenous peoples in the Arctic, to encourage new, stricter international standards in order to safeguard the rights and interests of indigenous peoples, as well as for the environmental protection of the Arctic, to elaborate and adopt documents that would limit not only the work of transnational companies and their impact on the environment, but also to include the national and domestic firms working in the Arctic areas. Now, I will stop reading from that specific document. This document is available in Russian and in English, so I believe that many here today, if they're interested, can read these documents on their own. Now, as regards the declaration itself, based on the summit outcomes, these documents will be forwarded to all of the different UN structures and agencies that are involved with indigenous peoples, and this declaration will also be submitted to the permanent forum. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias, señor.
Thank you very much, sir. Now, I give the floor to Hassan Ibil Hassan. You have the floor, sir.
استماعي مازر فلوري. بداية أود أن أشكر عروضهم حول الدراسات المختلفة التي تم إنجازها، ولكنني أود بالخصوص أن أشكر الزميلين كالفيرو وكارلوس على الدراسة التي قدمها بشأن الحقوق المتعلقة بالأرض. وملاحظتي في الواقع
My observations have to do with the rights because the issue do you hear the English channel? There was a technical problem I'm going to repeat. I said I would like to thank all the colleagues who presented the reports on their studies today. I wish to thank them for their efforts, and I wish in particular to deal with the report of Carlos and his colleague on the rights of our Mother Earth. My observations have to do with the philosophy of the right to move from the philosophy of the heavenly right to the earth right would require tremendous efforts in order to formulate the concepts. Why? Simply because I believe that the philosophy of heavenly rights focuses on the God-given rights. This philosophy was used by the religious and the clergy in order to dominate people and to dominate territories and also to usurp the rights of people at the level of the individual and collective freedoms and the rights to the land and other rights. I was at the village when we were hindered by the clouds of the volcano, and I visited an old building named Ladim, which were used by the church in order to impose taxes on the farmers in the past around this area. But I wish to say that the philosophy of rights is used either negatively or positively against people. States that have been formed afterwards may have had recourse to this philosophy, the philosophy of rights, in order to say that this right belongs to the state. It took a long time for people in order to acquire certain individual freedoms and rights. Some governments still take all the rights and divest the indigenous populations of their land and give the land to big corporations in order to establish huge projects, thus compromising the indigenous population. We're still struggling to attain a recognition of the rights of the indigenous peoples. Of course, a great development took place. That is in the international recognition of the indigenous people through the United Nations declarations on the right of indigenous peoples. However, this development is still limited to papers in most areas of the world. We will be able, through the earth right, to be able to find a right that would enable us to move from the enjoyment of the rights in the declaration that I mentioned, or the states would start anew, since the states believe that all the authority is in their hands. So they would use the philosophy of the right to earth in a negative direction. This is an issue that I put forward because I wish to present them to everyone, and I wish to recommend the two colleagues entrusted with this study to deepen their ideas around this issue in order that we may be able, on its basis, to realize how we can move from the philosophy of the rights that monopolize all rights to another philosophy that would grant all rights to the owners of these rights. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor Balcazán, por su.
Thank you very much, Mr. Balcazán, for your remarks. I will address your question a bit further on. My colleague, Tonya Gomelia, has spoken to us about the doctrine of discovery and how that doctrine has led precisely to considering discovery as a kind of divine right. And we, the indigenous peoples, have been a victim of this philosophy. We in the Americas have been victims of this kind of interpretation, Mr. Balcazar. I recall perfectly that when the Christians arrived here, they talked about the discovery and conquest, all based on divine right, because God gave them these lands, and the Pope issued bulls assigning these lands to European monarchs. And what we have tried to underscore is not this religious conception of nature. We must translate our thoughts, in my case, from Aymara, translate into Spanish, which is the language of the colonizers. And it is very difficult. It's not that we believe or disbelieve the existence of God. There are people such as the Guarani and the Mapuche peoples with whom we were talking last week. They do not believe in this, the existence of this God, this supreme individual. This is a totally Western and Christian idea, and we do not share that concept of divinity. And I repeat, sir, the indigenous peoples are victims of these interpretations, at least in the 16th century, and this has been handed down to the modern states. So we, and I individually, have tried to show that there is a different view of the earth. And when the Spaniards came, they thought that the earth was, the indigenous peoples considered the earth a goddess. And they felt that this had to be eliminated. And they had to instill us that the only God is their God, which is the one in their Bible. And it is their obligation to change our way of thinking. I have at no point wanted to consider that the earth is a god or a divinity, one that we consider ourselves owners of. In this connection, I would want to ask us all to think a little bit more broadly so that you can conceive of the fact that there are peoples that do not stem from the same root, philosophical and thought root. And people have come from other parts of the world and imposed on us violently their language, their religion. This was not a free choice or spontaneous. It was imposed on the points of spears. So, Mr. Belkacem, I know we will have more time to talk about this, but this conception of Mother Earth is totally divorced from this conception of a goddess that the West has. Let us now go over to our speakers list. We have as first speaker Ms. Isabel Ortega, Vice Minister of Justice of the Plurinational State of Bolivia. Madam Ortega, you have the floor. Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman of the International of the Forum, a cordial greeting to all of those on the presiding bureau and the participants and representatives of indigenous peoples.
Aymara Rutu Anchitura Sanakana Istanipsma is mi idioma nativo.
Aymara is my native language, and I am also Quechua.
Como el idioma.
We say the language of the invaders, in reference to Spanish. Today, our Mother Earth that we speak about, our Pachamama, is wounded. Why? Because the transnational corporations have attacked her with chemicals and all sorts of things, and the future of all of humanity is in danger because of this. If global warming is increased over 2 degrees, and there is a 50% probability, as expressed by Copenhagen, that the damage done to our Mother Earth, Pachamama, will be totally irreversible. And 20 to 30% of species would be in danger of disappearing. Great forests would be negatively impacted. How? With flooding and drought, not only in Bolivia, as I have heard in different areas as well, different regions of the planet would suffer desertification, and there would be a worsening of polar melting and melting of the glaciers in the Andes, the Himalayas, and in many island states, there would be a total disappearance as a result of rising sea levels, and there would be temperature increases in Africa of over 3 degrees, and production of food would be reduced around the world, and the effects of that would be catastrophic for the survival of the inhabitants of vast regions of the planet, and there would be a dramatic increase in the number of starving people in a world where the figure is already up in the millions of persons. Why Because as we have seen, there are in different places floods, because the transnationals do not take care of our Mother Earth. And that is why they mistreat our Mother Earth. That is why the transnational corporations of different so-called developed countries, we say development is all they want. They do not care about our Mother Earth. So, in complicity with a segment of populations, they set us to discussing climate change as a problem which only implies rising temperatures without going into analysis of the reasons. And the reason is the capitalist system. Many who do not live close to nature do not understand the suffering. When we are out in the countryside, when we pasture our flocks, you touch a stone and it burns you. The sun burns your skin. It is not as it was before. Now the cold is doubly cold. So we are not taking care of Mother Earth, and we reiterate that we must take care of our Mother Earth, Pachamama. The capitalist system has imposed a logic of competition, growth, and unlimited development. These production and consumption regimes pursues limitless profits, divorcing human beings from nature and attacking and reducing justice, ethics, or rights of peoples. That is, the capitalist system does not care for the earth. It does not recognize the rights of the indigenous peoples. It does not see the earth as our Pachamama. They do not care about the land. So, under capitalism, Mother Earth is turned into a source of raw materials for production and consumption in societies where people are worth what they have and not what they are. Capitalism requires a powerful military industry for their accumulation and control policies. They control our territories and our natural resources. How do they do this? By repression of the indigenous peoples, by crushing their resistance. This is an imperialist and colonialist system. Humanity is in the face of a choice, either death and depredation capitalism or the root of harmony with nature and respect for life. We must forge a new system that will reestablish harmony with nature, and so that humanity and nature can be in harmony only if there is equity among human beings. To deal with climate change, we must acknowledge Mother Earth as the source of life, and we must forge a new system based on principles of harmony and balance among all and with all. Complementarity, solidarity, and equity, collective well-being, satisfaction of basic needs of all in harmony with Mother Earth, Pachamama, respect for the rights of Mother Earth and human rights, acknowledgement of the human being for what they are, not for what they own. Elimination of all forms of colonialism, imperialism, and interventionism. Peace among all peoples and with Mother Earth, Pachamama. The model we are fostering is not one of destructive, unlimited development. Countries must produce goods and services to satisfy the basic needs of their populations, but they must not to continue along the wrong road to development, whereby the richest countries have an ecological footprint that is five times greater than what the planet can remedy. We have gone 30% over the planet's capability for regeneration. And at this rhythm of exploitation of our Mother Earth, we would need to have two planets by the year 2030. Brothers and sisters, I would at this point say that it is true. We all speak about rights. We all talk about justice because we must respect our Mother Earth, our Pachamama. And I am convinced that some do not. We respect our Mother Earth. With the coke leaf, we salute our Mother Earth. We chew the coke leaf in love, and we speak to the coca leaf as representative of our Mother Earth with love. We must all work to defend our Mother Earth and our lands. Thank you very much.
Usted, señora viceministra.
Thank you, Madam Vice Minister. The next speaker on my list is Ms. Shirley McPherson, chairperson of Indigenous Land Corporation in Australia. You have the floor, Ms. McPherson.
La palabra, señora.
You have the floor, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The impact of climate change on vulnerable Torres Strait communities is now a significant challenge for future preservation and growth of the Torres Strait's culture and identity. This is compounded by the effort to secure required resources from governments to take appropriate measures to mitigate adverse environmental, economic, cultural, and spiritual impact caused by this issue. Article 32, paragraph 1 of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples states that Indigenous peoples have the right to determine and develop priorities and strategies for the development or use of their lands or territories and other resources. Torres Strait communities are already feeling the impact of rising sea levels, and now every year during the summer when king tides are prevalent, our people's homes and sacred sites are inundated by the sea. Damage is being recorded on basic infrastructure such as seawalls, roads, housing, sewage, crops, and also has begun to wash away tombstones and graves. It is as if our history is being washed away in front of our eyes. Since our last intervention in 2009, the Torres Strait Regional Authority, in partnership with local government, has lobbied the Prime Minister of Australia and climate change and environmental ministers from both the Australian and Queensland governments to discuss the issue, as well as invite these decision makers to come and see for themselves the impact on our communities. The Torres Strait Regional Authority has also made submissions to a number of Australian and Queensland government committees investigating the impact of rising sea levels, and there has been increased media attention on the recent king tides in January and February this year. While most of these committees acknowledge that Torres Strait is vulnerable, there has still been limited success in securing the funds needed to develop and implement strategies to address this phenomenon over the intermediate to long-term future. We welcome the Australian and Queensland government's undertaking to assist our people to try and address this challenge, and we are working to ensure that this is an intergenerational commitment, because there are no short-term fixes for climate change. We have also been able to provide a briefing on climate change and Torres Strait development issues to both the former and current Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioners, and would like to acknowledge both Tom Carmer and Mick Gooder for their assistance in highlighting this issue in the Commission's reports. We are also thankful to the United Nations Special Rapporteur, James Ananaya, for also meeting with the Torres Strait Regional Authority and listening to the issues associated with our struggle. The Torres Strait Regional Authority has been proactive in the past 12 months, drafting a climate change strategy for our region that we hope will deal with the immediate threats while preparing our people for longer-term adaptation, but we can only do so much with limited resources. I wish to refer briefly to Article 32, Paragraph 3 of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I believe this article is relevant to the Torres Strait because of the willing support offered by Torres Strait Islander people living in the region that enables the Australian government to use our land and seas as a buffer to protect the Australian mainland. The Torres Strait is a valuable asset to the Australian government in managing its international border with Papua New Guinea, and so the well-being of our communities must be a priority in their own right. While we are doing everything within our level of influence and ability to help ourselves and adapt to climate change, it is quite possible in a scenario where we begin to see seasonal events such as flooding and inundation become more regular and intense, that Australia's first climate change refugees may be coming from our region. This is a reality that nobody in the Torres Strait wants to be realised, but it is a potential scenario that governments must be held accountable for if it unfolds, especially since we are identifying the trends now and have time to deal with it in a strategic, coordinated and sustained way. I urge this forum and others like it that are able to engage with national governments to continue to monitor the impact of climate change in the Torres Strait and continue to assist us in creating a long-term whole-of-government and community solution that will protect and maintain our traditional homeland now and in the future. Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Christina Nordlink of the Sami Council. You have the floor, madam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Today, the Sami Council would like to comment on the study to determine the impact of climate change adaptation and mitigation measures on radon herding, presented by Mr. Lars Anders Bär, the expert on the forum. Paragraph E37. I would like to report on recent developments in regards to this windmill project in Östra Kikkija, our Sami community. The Swedish state has admitted that the project will destroy at least 25% of the Sami community's winter reindeer herding pastures, but the state has argued that renewable energy is more important than Sami rights. The financer of the project's first phase, the German bank KfW IPEX Bank, has defended their investment by referring to the Swedish state's approval of the project. But the state planning permission, and thereby the bank's financing, are in breach of international law because Sami rights are not being respected. The Sami community has been in contact with the German bank and has highlighted the fact that the bank's financing of the project is not in line with the bank's commitments regarding human rights, indigenous rights, and environmental sustainability. The Sami community has also requested a meeting with the bank, but the bank has ignored the community's request. In their communication with the community, the bank claim that its commitments do not apply to projects in OECD countries and therefore are not relevant to Sweden. The bank argues that they follow Swedish law and the decisions of Swedish public authorities, and that this is guarantee enough that Sami rights are respected. Mr. Chairman, the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises apply, of course, to projects in all countries, and Sweden is no exception. This wind power project risks making reindeer herding unviable in the area and is therefore in breach of the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises. Mr. Chairman, I would like to report that 2 weeks ago, the Sami Council has lodged a complaint over the German KfW IPEX Bank's financing of the wind power project. We argue that the project is socially unsustainable and in breach of Sami rights. Sweden has received repeated and harsh international critique from the CERD Committee and the Human Rights Committee because Sweden breaches Sami land rights by not regulating resource development activities on traditional Sami lands and does not give Sami communities the opportunity for effective participation in decisions that affect them. And Mr. Chairman, I will now give our recommendations to the forum, and these are joint recommendations by the Arctic Caucus, the Sami Council, and the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. Mr. Chairman, we recommend that the permanent forum conduct a study on the impact of loss of reindeer grazing lands due to exploitation of natural resources in the Arctic. The Sami Council and the ICC would support such a study and do what we can to contribute to it. The Permanent Forum members are limited in their resources and time constraints to produce all such reports, and we believe the way forward for the Permanent Forum work in the future is to also draw upon experts that work outside the forum. We urge the Secretariat to give priority to these types of collaborative projects. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, the Sami Council and the ICC would urge the Permanent Forum to make the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples a living document in the UN system that is used and referred to as much as possible, and that the Forum should do this in close cooperation with the MRIP and the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Peoples' Rights. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Muchas gracias a usted por.
Thank you very much for that offer to support the research. Now, I'd like to call on Mr. Thomas Aslak Tuso of the Sami Parliament Council. Mr. Aslak has the floor. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the behalf of the Sami Parliamentarian Council, we would like to support the proposal made just by the Sami Council to conduct a study on the impact of loss of reindeer grazing lands due to the exploitation of natural resources in the Arctic. The study made by Permanent Forum member Mr. Lars Anders Pär shows very clearly the necessity due to the due of such study. Thank you, Chair.
Gracias por el apoyo. Estamos viendo.
Thank you for that support. We're witnessing some interesting coordination between Sami, different Sami representatives. This might be an example for other region. Now, Mr. Kenneth Verr of the World Indigenous Association, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a joint statement by the Indigenous World Association and other indigenous bodies in the Pacific area. The human rights of the indigenous peoples of the Pacific are being threatened and abridged by the United States and other states acting in concert with UNESCO and the World Heritage Committee, including its affiliates, the World Conservation Union, and the International Council of Monuments and Sites, These parties are acting in collusion to deny indigenous fishing and harvesting of marine resources in their traditional oceanic areas. This is a critical issue for food sovereignty for indigenous Pacific peoples because 95% of the protein comes from the Pacific Ocean. No consultation has been provided to indigenous peoples in the areas impacted. We note the report on indigenous fishing rights in the seas with the case studies from Australia and Norway by the Pacific expert Mick Dodson, who makes it clear that international law affirms and protects the right of indigenous peoples of the Pacific to fish for subsistence and economic development purposes, and cites the specific provisions of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Articles 3, 8, 20, and 26, which apply to this right, as well as Article 27 of the ICCPR. The report also notes that the Permanent Forum is responsible for the follow-up of the declarations, the implementation of the declaration under Provision 42. Problems relating to the taking of indigenous lands and resources for conservation are acknowledged in the report entitled State of the World's Indigenous Peoples, which was recently released. This report identified the disenfranchisement of indigenous peoples from their resources, lands, and territories. It also noted that powerful environmental and conservation groups were working with states to designate protected areas, then removing the indigenous, preventing and criminalizing their cultural practices, and transforming them into conservation refugees. This is a global problem that must be directly addressed by this forum. Here are some examples of indigenous human rights violations in American, Samoa, Guam, and Hawaii. The Pew Foundation, created by the Blue Legacy for President Bush to ostensibly protect the marine resources of the ocean. However, environmental protection was not the priority in these areas. Instead, military activities, extraction research, and globalized tourism were. Indigenous Hawaiians opposed a marine reserve in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. They demonstrated that the Bush Conservation Plan did not protect marine resources and, in fact, violated state and federal environmental law. In order to avoid addressing these serious issues, a presidential executive order went through on January 6, 2009, which the Bush administration took over 195,000 square miles of traditional territories of Pacific indigenous peoples. Traditional fishing practices and all commercial fishing were denied. Japanese and Caucasian commercial fishers received nearly $7 million in compensation. Indigenous fishers received nothing. Other examples are public hearings held by the U.S. Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council. On November 2009, traditional Samoan chiefs opposed the Rose Atoll Monument. In 2008, Chamorro fishermen were arrested for engaging in traditional fishing activities. The UNESCO, the World Heritage Commission, ICOMOS, and IUCN are all currently supporting the U.S. nomination of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands to the UNESCO Heritage List, World Heritage List. They have held no consultations with indigenous fishers impacted by these policies. In May and June of 2009, the U.S. held a consultation in Hawaii on the list of on the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. No notice was provided to the community. Only four people attended. They were invited by the NOAA. No record of this meeting is available, and UNESCO has informed Hawaiians that the 1972 convention does not oblige UNESCO or any other body to consult with indigenous peoples. From November 2009, UNESCO has refused to provide the Pacific Action Plan to Hawaiians and has invited indigenous Pacific peoples to instead raise these issues directly with the World Heritage Commission. The Pacific interveners are prepared to formally complain to UNESCO and will forward a copy to the forum. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, we request that the Permanent Forum call upon UNESCO, the World Heritage Commission, IUCN, ICOMOS, and the State of Brazil to declare a moratorium on implementation of the Pacific World Heritage Action Plan until these bodies consult with the impacted indigenous peoples of the Pacific. Second, interveners, Nakoa Aikeka, Okalui, Hawaii, and the Kauai Foundation from Hawaii and indigenous interveners from Guam suggest the forum participate in our efforts to sponsor consultations in Hawaii and Guam with UNESCO, WHC, ICOMOS, and IUCN. We request that the forum send the Pacific representative, the special rapporteur James Anaya, and other indigenous experts from the Pacific and Norway to participate in these sessions with the goal of drafting and adopting a policy to implement the Declaration's human rights protections in the work of UNESCO, the World Heritage Commission, ICOMOS, and the IUCN. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, sir. Continuing with our speakers list, I'm going to recognize Florina Lopez of the Foundation for the Promotion of Indigenous Knowledge. Land is Life. You have the floor, Mrs. Lopez. I wanted to present the following declaration on behalf of the Foundation for the Promotion of the Fund. I also want to thank the United Nations for this opportunity. Mr. Chairman, in recent times we have all heard that there are great disasters, torrential rains, storms, drought, volcanoes. All this is considered the impact of climate change, that is, sudden changes that take place in a matter of minutes. You may recall the hurricanes that devastated hundreds of villages in a very short time. This is happening with greater frequency. It is not an isolated event every 50 years. These are phenomena that are taking place several times a year, and not in a single country, but in many. Mr. Chairman, the countries that are polluting give us false notions which affect our and increase our poverty. The uprooting of many peoples for the sake of stopping deforestation and developing clean mechanisms to mitigate climate change, as indigenous peoples and especially indigenous women have been protecting our resources. Those who today want to base their solutions quite often on violation of human rights, while the overwhelming majority of countries that have adopted the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples of the United Nations are violating this international instrument. In other terms, climate change is a fact, and it will continue to impact our lives. That is why we can and must, based on traditional knowledge, understand that we have inherited this from our ancestors, and we know that we must work together to present different alternatives. As alternative women, we must raise our voices in policy making fora and in the law as creators of the present and a better future. Therefore, we recommend the following to the permanent forum. 1. Monitor implementation of the Declaration on Indigenous Rights in all countries. 2. That all mitigation and adaptation plans take into account as a foundation acknowledgement of the rights of indigenous peoples. 3. That all initiatives on climate change take into account the informed prior knowledge of the indigenous peoples. 4. That the participation of indigenous peoples must be full and real throughout the process to design and implement mitigation plans considering the worldview of our peoples. 5. That the permanent forum organize a world indigenous conference to deal with matters of supreme importance such as climate change, traditional knowledge, and the rights of indigenous peoples, among others. Thank you very much, sir.
Gracias, señora López.
Thank you, Ms. Lopez. Now, the following speaker on my list, Charles Dileva of the World Bank. Mr. Dileva, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the honor of permitting the World Bank to make this intervention. My name is Charles Dileva. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Environmental Law Unit in the World Bank. At this fora and in other related fora, the World Bank has been asked to comment on two questions that have been directed to it. The first question is, will the World Bank revise its operational policy on indigenous peoples to make it consistent with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, in particular the rights to FPIC, Free Prior Informed Consent? The second question is, will the World Bank apply its safeguard policies, in particular the Indigenous Peoples Policy, to the new forest and climate change initiatives, including the Forest Carbon Partnership Facility? And I'd like to present the answers to those two questions. To the first question, World Bank management has committed to present to the bank's board a review of the operation of the bank's policy on indigenous peoples, as well as a portfolio review regarding World Bank-financed investment projects that affect indigenous peoples. As part of that presentation, we will note that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples expressly incorporates free, prior, and informed consent, and that countries continue to adopt the declaration, as witnessed last year by the government of Australia and this past week by the government of New Zealand, as well as the renewed consideration of adoption by Canada and the U.S. We will also note the view of indigenous peoples as reflected in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and some commentators and other stakeholders that FPIC has become an established principle of international law, recognizing as well that the term has deep resonance for all indigenous peoples. We do submit that the declaration is not a legally binding treaty and that there is no uniformly accepted definition of FPIC. We also note that many of the governments that adopted the declaration have qualified their endorsement on what the declaration means in their national context. Having stated the above, any revision to the bank's policy must be endorsed by the World Bank's Board of Executive Directors. As a multilateral organization, when the bank adopts a policy, it seeks to avoid any qualifications that could weaken uniform understanding across its 186 member governments. Further, our view is that the current bank operational policy on indigenous peoples is not inconsistent with the principle of FPIC. This view is based in large part because investment projects that affect indigenous peoples can only proceed after there has been free, prior, and informed consultation, and at the end of the consultation process, the broad community support of the affected indigenous peoples for the project has been acquired, as such community support is defined by the indigenous community itself. Please also note that in ascertaining this broad community support, we can look to guidelines such as those for implementing consultation with indigenous peoples under the World Bank Forest Investment Program that was developed by and with indigenous peoples leaders, as well as guidelines detailed in the forthcoming guidebook on the implementation of World Bank policy on indigenous peoples led by Navin Rai, the World Bank Indigenous Peoples Advisors. To the second question, all activities financed under the Forest Carbon Partnership Facility and climate funds will be screened to determine if they have potential for impacts on indigenous peoples. And if they do, the bank's indigenous peoples policy will be applied. Of course, the proportion by which the policy is applied depends on the nature and degree of impacts. For example, planning activities at the upstream strategic stage might not require the same degree of safeguard policy application as would a project that proposes concrete implementation measures. If an activity has the potential for impact, we will apply the policy based upon close consultation with indigenous peoples, using the policy and guidelines for consultation that have been developed with the help of indigenous peoples, and in a manner that is culturally appropriate, meaningful, effective, and in a manner and form understandable and accessible to all potentially affected indigenous peoples. Thank you once again, Mr. Chair.
Gracias a usted. Nuestro próximo.
Thank you, sir. The next speaker on my list is Ms. Charlotte Schater. Ms. Schater of Sweden has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. And I take the floor this time in relation to the report submitted by Lars Anders Bear on the impact of climate change on reindeer herding. And this is something which has been recognized in the Swedish context. As was mentioned in the report, the Swedish Commission on Climate Change and Vulnerability studied the effects on reindeer herding and in its 2007 report concluded that reindeer herding in Sweden will be significantly affected by climate change. Some effects are a direct consequence of climate change, such as longer vegetation periods. Other effects are indirect. For example, as forestry expands to new areas, there will be an increased risk of conflict of interest between forestry and reindeer herding. The report points out that several factors raised by the Swedish Commission are likely to be relevant to other reindeer herding regions as well. The Commission proposed a number of points for follow-up to its conclusions and pointed to the Swedish Sami Parliament as the central actor in this regard. This issue was also included in a Swedish government bill on an integrated climate and energy policy, which was presented last year. In this context, 29 million Swedish crowns, approximately $4 million, have been allocated to the Sami Parliament for the purpose of studying options and to meet the changed conditions for the reindeer industry caused by climate change. And finally, when I have the floor, I would also like to say that I've taken due note of the issue raised by the Sami Council and which pertains to Sweden. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Muchas gracias a usted.
Thank you very much, ma'am, for those remarks. Now I'm going to give the floor to Tonia Gonelia Fritschner. You have the floor, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a very short response to the distinguished representative from the World Bank. I'd like to thank him for coming to our meeting and responding to some of our discussion today. And I was quite happy to hear that there, and I hope I heard it correctly, that there would be some review and on policies that have to do with indigenous issues as far as the World Bank was concerned. But I was dismayed to hear that the free, prior, and informed consultation would still be the paradigm that would be continued to use. As you know, Mr. Chairman, free, prior, and informed consent is the principle that we have fought for over 30 years and is reflected in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and that Indigenous peoples have been part of the consultation process within the World Bank in terms of its development policies. And we have encouraged the World Bank to use free, prior, and informed consent rather than consultation. I will have a more elaborate discussion later on, probably tomorrow, on the Forest Community Project and the Carbon Facility Project for the representative of the World Bank. But I would like to express my concern about the inability to use consent rather than, or consultation rather than consent. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias, señora Gonella.
Thank you, Ms. Gonella. Now the floor goes to Victoria Tauli Kurpus. You have the floor, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to take the floor briefly to make my comment also on what the World Bank has said, and I totally support the earlier statement made by my colleague, Tonya Gunella Frischner, related to her comment on the difference between free prior informed consent and free prior informed consultation. I think Mr. De Leyva was saying that the experience, the practice of free prior informed consultation with broad community support is substantially equivalent to free prior informed consent. And if the bank believes that that is so, I would really like to see more documentation of the experiences that the bank has had in relation to getting to implementing free prior informed consultation. Because by having those kinds of case studies, wherein we can see whether really the consent or the broad community support has been gathered, what has been the process to gather broad community support, how do you define broad community support, because there are also different kinds of communities. I think it's worthwhile, and I would like to suggest this to the bank, that they can make some case documentation of these experiences that they have, and then bring it before the permanent forum, and we can see whether it's really something that can be substantially equivalent, both in process and as well as in substance, to the free prior informed consent that is contained in the declaration. The second comment I'd like to make is just to briefly comment also on the point that Mr. De Leyva has mentioned, which he says that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is not a legally binding document. No, I think this has been something that we have been discussing continuously in the past, that while it may be true that it's not a legally binding document because it's not a convention, but it has a lot of articles already which are legally binding in nature. And we say this because many of the articles in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples are articles that are picked up from the existing conventions and covenants. Now, whether this is the Convention on Human Rights, the Covenant on Human Rights, on Civil and Political Rights, or the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, as well as the Covenant, the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. So many of these articles are actually picked up from those existing legally binding documents. So it's not just so easy to dismiss the declaration to say that it's not a legally binding document. I think there are many of the articles in that declaration itself has some legally binding has some articles which are legally binding in nature, and I hope that that kind of view will also be corrected, because it doesn't really represent what the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is all about. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Señor Clavero, tiene usted la palabra.
Mr. Clavero, you have the floor.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Thank you very much, sir. I wanted to speak along the same lines that my colleagues spoke, because the intervention of the World Bank is a satisfaction in the sense that they are cooperating with the forum, but it is also a source of concern. I believe the World Bank cannot interpret international instruments of human rights. They cannot support states that violate international human rights instruments and the the document on indigenous human rights is an international document, human rights instruments. They have said that it is not a binding treaty. It has been described as a non-binding treaty, and not all treaties are binding. If they were all binding, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights would cease to be important, and the World Bank cannot interpret the World Declaration of Human Rights. I would like to ask the World Bank how they understand Article 42 of the Declaration on Indigenous Rights. Article 42, I have the text here in English only.
It's including the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and specialized agencies, including at the country level and states, shall promote respect for and full application of the provision, etc. Si el Banco Mundial...
If the World Bank does not feel affected by this statement, and if they understand that the states mentioned in Article 42 may interpret as they like what it says here, and does the World Bank, may the World Bank support and allow these countries to violate these instruments? This declaration is not a binding treaty, but that does not mean that it is not an international instrument of human rights, and one that ties in the bank, because the bank is not a committee of human rights that can interpret things with the complicity of states regarding the contents of the declaration. That is all. Thank you.
Gracias, señor Clavero.
Thank you, sir. Our next speaker on my list is Sandra Nelson Zongo of the World Federation. Is Ms. Zongo in the room? The next speaker is Celeste McKay of the Association of Native Women of Canada. And she will be speaking on behalf of the American Indian Global Alliance. Is Ms. Celeste McKay here? You have the floor, ma'am.
Mr. Chairperson, honorable permanent forum members, distinguished delegates, and Indigenous representatives, thank you for the opportunity to speak about the expert group meeting on Indigenous children and youth in detention, custody, foster care, and adoption. I thank permanent forum member Ms. Tanya Ganella Frischner and Ms. Andrea Carmen, EGM rapporteur, for their reports this morning. I would like to emphasize the importance of continuing to work in this area through holding a further EGM in 2010. In addition to the important general conclusions highlighted by Andrea Carmen, I would like to highlight the following specific conclusion in relation to Indigenous women and girls in paragraph 80 of the full written report of the expert group meeting. Solutions to the systemic barriers leading to the overrepresentation of Indigenous youth and children in detention, custody, foster care, and adoption must also consider the particular impacts on and effects of discrimination experienced by Indigenous women. These include lack of support provided to single-parented, low-income families, the majority of which are headed by Indigenous women. This contributes to the overrepresentation of Indigenous children in the child welfare system, as well as to the criminalization of Indigenous girls who are sexually exploited at a young age. Further, adequate provision for the care of children while Indigenous mothers are in custody needs to be ensured. The development and application of culturally relevant gender-based analysis is also required to understand and overcome the particular impacts on Indigenous women and girls. During our side event held on the expert group meeting last week, we heard from the Indigenous Youth Caucus, who indicated their interest in participating in the follow-up work of the EGM. We recommend that the permanent forum review and adopt the recommendations set out by the experts at the EGM as set out by Andrea Carmen earlier and contained in this statement as Appendix A. Further, we recommend that representatives from the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus of the Permanent Forum be welcome to partner on any further initiatives as their voices and perspectives will enhance the work completed. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Mr. Pirison Pradhan of the Indigenous Caucus of Asia. You have the floor, sir. Is he here in the room? You have the floor, sir.
Respected Chairperson, considering the enormity of the challenges the global community faces today and the Indigenous people's demonstration of our willingness to proactively engage in that joint effort, we demand the rights of Indigenous peoples to participate in the permanent forum should not be infringed upon due to their nationality, gender, and political situation in their country. Sir, we have the following recommendations. That the permanent forum and its secretariat continue to work in engaging UN member states in a constructive manner and help create an enabling environment for states and Indigenous peoples to dialogue. We acknowledge and salute those UN member states that have come forward to dialogue despite having to address difficult questions of its past and its present. We urge the other UN member states, particularly from Asia, to actively participate in these dialogues. Two, we urge the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum to follow up on the dialogues and specific recommendations with UN agencies and intergovernmental bodies within the mandate provided for it by the ECOSOC. Three, we reiterate our call made at the previous sessions, including the 8th session, wherein we suggested that the implementation of the UN RIP, the dialogue with the Special Rapporteur, and comprehensive dialogue with specific UN agencies and funds be made permanent agenda of the UNPFII. Four, we appreciate the CBD for having a comprehensive dialogue with states, members of Permanent Forum, Indigenous Peoples Organizations, and observers in this session. We urge other UN agencies, programs, and funds to come forward in such dialogues in the future. Sir, we further urge the PFII to submit relevant reports to UN CSD sessions, especially the following CSD 18 review session to be held this May, which will primarily focus on the following thematic issues such as mining, waste management, chemicals, along with the 10-year framework program on sustainable consumption and production patterns. The same issues have been reported by Indigenous peoples to the 9th session of the Permanent Forum and should therefore be reported to the UN CSD 18 session. Sir, the Permanent Forum makes substantive comments over the report of the... Representative of the Secretary General on the issue of human rights and transnational corporations and other business corporations. We believe that this is a step towards operationalization of the Protect, Respect, and Remedy framework. Sir, the Permanent Forum should conduct a study on the status of the implementation of the Chittagong Hill Tracts Accord of 1997. This is very critical in the achievement of peace, justice, and development in the CHT. For the PFII to institutionalize in its future work the conduct of interactive dialogue with government representatives on thematic or emerging issues, in particular, we express our appreciation to the Permanent Forum, permanent mission of Norway and its ambassador on environment for organizing the site event on RED and partnership agreement. Sir, the caucus reiterates the importance of taking further effective measures to remove obstacles to realization of the rights of people to self-determination, and in particular, peoples living under forced occupation, which continue to adversely affect the economic and social development and are incompatible with the dignity and worth of the human person and must be combated and eliminated. Lastly, sir, the Permanent Forum makes substantive comments over the... Sir, I'm done. Thank you, sir.
Disculpe.
I was apologizing because I had not turned on my microphone. The next speaker is Marco Espinosa Miranda of the Confederation of Amazon Nations of Peru. You have the floor, sir. Is the gentleman present? Good afternoon. Yes, I am. You have the floor, sir. Distinguished members of the United Nations, representatives of indigenous organizations, participants, I convey to you the salutations of the CONAP, Mr. Alvaran Sanchez. Our confederation, a organization that I am representative, is a civil association that is a representative organization of some 40 regional organizations of native communities, and it comprises a number of ethnic groups in the Amazon region. In connection with the issue at hand, we believe that the development of the indigenous peoples has two dimensions. First, to strengthen identity, culture of the indigenous people so that globalizations will have its own collective self-respect that will be capable of dealing with the challenges of modernity. And the second, which complements the first, an opening of to the opportunities offered by modernity as long as they contribute to sustainable development and truly improve living conditions. Unfortunately, in my country, the government identified development with economic growth linked to figures such as the gross domestic product. This in order to justify public expenses. The national budget centers on infrastructure works that are more often than not carried out without consulting the indigenous peoples that are going to be affected. In connection with climate change, we must say that the Amazon region is at risk because the government, in a cooperation agreement with Brazil, plans to execute large works such as hydroelectric dams and highways, whose environmental impact studies have been questioned by a number of organizations such as the College of Engineers and by the indigenous peoples of Del Boca Nambari in the case of the hydroelectric station, which will be built by two Brazilian construction companies. Our organization is a valid interlocutor of the state, characterized by a critical position and one that enters into a dialogue to forward promotions that will work for the benefit of the indigenous peoples of Peru. In harmony with our dual conception of development and given the needs of the indigenous peoples of the Amazonian region, we center projects on those aimed at reforestation, ceramics, reforestation, and others. On the other hand, with a view to social development, we must ensure that these projects reach the populations that have the greatest need, so that once the basic needs of food, health, education are solved, they can then go to develop their own cultures, training their own leaders, who in time will become indigenous persons that are proud of their identity. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, sir. Now we are going to hear remarks from our colleagues. Margaret Okawa has the floor.
Hi. Thank you very much, Chairman. I have had a few interventions after listening to so many statements. The first observation I want to make is on the statement given by our brother from World Bank, much as other colleagues of mine have already mentioned, I want to urge you, our colleagues from World Bank, that as well as they do not comply with the principle of free, prior, and informed consent, they will always get resistance from indigenous peoples. The other one is about the two studies that were conducted by our colleagues. First of all, I want to appreciate the much effort that was put to produce these tremendous reports. The issue I want to speak here is about nomadism. Nomadism or pastoralism is normally perceived to be a primitive practice because indigenous peoples, you know, use land friendly and find that the use of land to them is very important. The climatic conditions have affected the patterns of life of indigenous peoples. More especially, the impact has gone to women and children. It is for this reason that the Permanent Forum at its ninth session made a tremendous recommendation concerning pastoralism. The other observation I want to make is the one of the Mother Earth. When you read the report, it signifies how important indigenous peoples have for a long time interacted with Mother Earth. And it is therefore my recommendation that the states promote policies and treaties that protect the nature of Mother Earth. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you, ma'am. Now, Mike Lodson will have the floor. You have the floor, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my brief intervention is to respond to our colleague from the World Bank, Mr. De Laver's intervention. I want to thank him for the intervention and the opportunity to engage on this ongoing discussion dialogue about the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I express some concern about the tendency going back to the adoption of the Declaration by the General Assembly for some states and actors to seek to qualify the Declaration. Article 43, Mr. Chairman, says that these are the minimum standards. No. The minimum standard, not as qualified by an agency or a government or an intergovernmental body or any other organ of the United Nations system. Article 1 says that we have a right to enjoy, both individually and collectively, all the human rights and freedoms recognised in international law. Not as qualified in international law by government, UN organ, other body, or indeed the World Bank. Article 2 says that we all are equal to, we as Indigenous peoples are equal to all other peoples, you know, and we must be free from discrimination. It doesn't allow government or other parts of the United Nations system or intergovernmental bodies or whoever to say, well, we're going to qualify that. You know, you're not fully free from discrimination. We think we should be able to qualify that. You know. Article 28, Mr. Chairman, Article 38 says that governments are to take measures to give effect to this declaration. Not to give qualified effect to this declaration, there's to give effect to the declaration. And finally, Mr. Chairman, the principle ought to be reiterated that when the world in the community of the United Nations sets an international standard, it's for the states and other actors to comply with those standards in an unqualified way. It's not open for everybody to have a different qualification on it. What's meant to happen, particularly in so far as states are concerned, is they're meant to rearrange, if inconsistent, they're meant to rearrange their constitutional legal arrangements to fit the instrument, not the other way around. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted por su.
Thank you, sir, for those important remarks and clarifications of the importance of the declaration. Ms. Elisa Kanki, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will talk here behind the International Indigenous Working Group in HIV and AIDS, which I am part of that. And we would like to congratulate you on your election to chair. We would also like to recognize New Zealand's endorsement for the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Data of HIV and AIDS among Indigenous people is only available for a few countries. Where the data is available, ethnicity information is often not collected. Although this is a big problem and increasing the cases among Indigenous people, especially in the areas where the extractive industries are entering, and in urban areas where the Indigenous people are displaced for these activities. There, women and youth Indigenous people are more vulnerable than other population. For that, we are here in the United Nations Permanent Forum to introduce our group and call on governments and the international community to support our Indigenous sisters and brothers who are doing this work. It is overview that colonization is a key feature of the Indigenous people experience around HIV and AIDS, and strategies to address the damaging legacy of colonization must be central to an effective policy and practical response. This involves advocacy for implementation of international human rights instruments such as the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, asserting collective rights of self-determination in the design and delivery of health services, and working to reform institutions and services for Indigenous people. Instrumental to our effort is the use of Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous social determinants of health approach in policy and program planning, and to respect of diversity among Indigenous peoples globally and their sociocultural context, through networking and sharing of wise practices and promoting cultural appropriate knowledge transfer. To this end, care must be taken to avoid a one-size-fits-all approach to the design of HIV-AIDS policy and practice for Indigenous people. The International Group is a permanent body of Indigenous people working within the HIV and AIDS movement with commitment to the integration of Indigenous issues into existing and future activities globally. The group is a mechanism to seek to provide and unify voices for Indigenous people, and a structure for collective action to raise HIV problem issues in the international arena and coordinate Indigenous response to the global Indigenous HIV-AIDS epidemic, and an instrument to call on state and the international community to fully support Indigenous people's initiatives. The international group recommends we call the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to recognize the international group working on HIV and AIDS as the structure and mechanism to relate and address indigenous HIV AIDS. Related matters at an international level. We call on the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to urge states and the international community to fully support indigenous driving initiatives and process, which should be at the center of international responses to the HIV-AIDS epidemic. Fully supporting these indigenous-led initiatives means providing adequate, sustainable, and upfront funding to allow for the meaningful involvement of indigenous peoples globally. This includes human, technical, and financial support. Thank you, Chairman.
Gracias por.
Thank you for your contribution, Ms. Kanki. Now, Tauli Kolpus has the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to speak again. I just would like to pick up on the issue on the statement that was made by the Asia Indigenous People's Caucus, where they referred to the need to have more dialogues, interactive dialogues with government representatives. And they referred to the lunchtime event this noon, where the Minister of Environment and Development of Norway came to have a dialogue with indigenous peoples regarding the interim red partnership that they are supporting. And I think that that is a practice that maybe need to be emulated more in the future, because this the minister has really come all the way from Norway just to be here to present their initiatives and also to gather feedback from indigenous peoples and the members of the forum who are here now. I think that kind of practice can be encouraged much more, both for them to come here to really present some of the ideas or initiatives that they are taking, which needs the response and feedback of indigenous peoples, as well as during side events where this will be held. Just to briefly give you an idea of what was the side event all about, it was about the interim red initiative of the Norwegian, which was led by the Norwegian and the French government. And now it is going to hold a high-level summit in May 27 in Oslo to discuss and to launch this initiative. Indigenous peoples have expressed their fear or their worries and concerns about this because of the very fast pace in which this kind of thing is happening, which is quite understandable because according to the concept that they have shown, they have shared, they would like to build on the momentum that has been achieved in the Copenhagen processes in relation to forests and climate change. However, we stressed in the panel, because we were asked to make responses to his presentation, we stressed that, first of all, the safeguard mechanisms that are already embedded in the red agreements the draft agreements reached so far in Copenhagen should really be a foundation upon which this partnership is built. And the safeguards are the safeguards on respecting the rights of indigenous peoples as contained in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Secondly, the safeguards to stop conversion of natural forests into other uses. Thirdly, to ensure that there is good forest governance. And fourthly, to ensure the environment
fundamental integrity of the whole RED process. But we also stress that the inclusion of indigenous peoples in these initiatives from the local up to the global level has to really be ensured, because we don't believe that it's only governments who should be discussing about it. Indigenous peoples who are from tropical rainforests who will be directly affected by this initiative should certainly be part of the whole mechanism, you know, whether this is at the local or at the global level. And I think we stressed that very strongly before him, and I hope he was able to absorb those suggestions. And I would like to end by saying that maybe the permanent forum should also support that position that that we presented before the minister, to ensure that the voices in relation to ensuring that the rights are not going to be violated, and that indigenous peoples will be the ones who will benefit from this, and that all these safeguards will be respected. I hope that we will be able to strongly support that those kinds of recommendations, because we believe that unless the rights and the participation are ensured, these kinds of initiatives are not going to flourish. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Gracias, señora Tauli.
Thank you, Ms. Tauli Corpus. The next speaker on my list is Jorge Quilaqueo of the Mapuche grouping. Is Mr. Quilaqueo present? You have the floor, Mr. Quilaqueo.
Inche huechehuentu machi, inche calfurrayen machi. Buenos días, hermanos y hermanas.
Good day, brothers and sisters. The Mapuche nation is here in the United Nations, and as a traditional authority, I come with the cosmology and philosophy of our progenitors to defend the rights of our Mother Earth and the right to cultural and traditional development of my people. We are an ancestral culture. We have spiritual knowledge that has survived for 14,000 years. But the colonization begun by the state of Chile began 200 years ago, and they are celebrating it today. We say there is nothing to celebrate. Repression and trampling that we have suffered, the millions of tons of garbage generated every month, imply multiple impacts to our people's territories, environmentally, culturally, economically, and health-wise. Thus, a new focus of conflict arises on this new form of intervention in our communities, which is a different form of discrimination, environmental racism. The garbage goes to our lands and is left near our ceremonial centers and schools. The background information allows us to understand the impact that these garbage dumps have on the Mapuche people. We have 19 dumps, representing 70% of the total precincts, which is another form of discrimination. Of the 16,000 tons produced in the region, more than 11 tons go to regions where the dumps border on or within our communities. Our communities have insisted on the gravity of this situation, and they have denounced this pollution stemming from these garbage dumps, especially the challenging of the ecosystem and the defiling of sacred sites. Furthermore, most of the dumps in Mapuche territory are lacking in adequate infrastructure and have inadequate care. These dumps also imply changes in the lives of our families and have made of garbage a form of dependence. The marginalization of our regions and scarce possibilities for development force our young people to emigrate in search of opportunities. We call for an elimination of these garbage dumps to cease having this impact on our Mother Earth. We second and welcome the Declaration of the United Nations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and suggest one, deny the colonialist constitution that has not been supported by us. Second, as Mapuche people, we are committed to protection of our lands and our natural resources, so we will use all resources and Agreement 169 to protect our Mother Earth. We furthermore denounce publicly that Chilean government has no commitment to the Mapuche people and the Water Code, where we are deprived of a vital element, and this is against Article 32 of the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples. Without land and without water, they are depriving us of light. Third, the anti-terrorist law must not be used any further. We are not terrorists because we are defending our territory. Fourth, the Human Rights Council should intercede with the government of Chile to insist on protection of the human rights of the Mapuches, cessation of violent acts of repression, usurpation by the transnationals of our resources, pollution of our lands and waters, and deforestation of our lands. I have a brief annex, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mamani, with regard to something that you have said in our language. If you're going to speak of our language, prefer first inform yourself with our elders and not books, because these are Western concepts. The only ones authorized to talk about the Mapuche are the Mapuche. And we condemn the agreements signed with Spain. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, brother. Precisely based on the statement of our Mapuche brother, I think it is important that we underscore the way that studies are done in the Permanent Forum. The studies that we have heard today were all done, as stated in the recommendations on which the studies are based, with no financial consequences for the Permanent Forum. All of the rapporteurs that we have heard today have worked with no remuneration for that work. And I would like to take this occasion to thank a number of institutions for having supported those studies. So, esteemed Mapuche brother, the fact is that in my case, I was not able to visit the Mapuche territory to speak to the elders or the Machis. If we had that kind of funding, then we could have gone to your lands and we would certainly have consulted the Machis. So this is a difficulty, and I want to thank the members of the forum for the work they have done voluntarily throughout all of the existence of the forum, and especially in this year when we have heard so many studies and which we have heard during today's session. We have come to the end of our session. The Permanent Forum has wound up its examination of these studies as part of its examination of Item 7. The Forum will continue examining Agenda Item 7 tomorrow at its 11th session, tomorrow, the 27th of April, as of 10 o'clock a.m. Do we have any announcements? The meeting is adjourned.